I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact, among others. The Children's Television Workshop, now called the Sesame Workshop, started the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in 2007 to study the effects of digital technology on childhood literacy. Joan was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1990, and she's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you remember your first introduction to the alphabet or numbers?
Well, I do, as a matter of fact. I did not go to kindergarten, but I started first grade before I was six. And I don't think I'd been taught the alphabet, because I remember it being on cards around the room, and I got it right away. I was so ready for school, having not gone to kindergarten, that I started reading pretty quickly and knowing the alphabet.
How come you didn't go to kindergarten?
My mother didn't want me to leave home. I was the last of her three children, and so she had made me stay at home. So here I was, raring to go by the time I got to first grade at five.
Do you remember, was there a book popular or part of the cultural zeitgeist that you can recall when you were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old? Like, what was your Sesame Street?
I don't remember the children's books that I was read, because... For one thing, the books that were being read were probably aimed slightly higher than my age, because my three of us were born in 3 years and 3 months, and I was the youngest. So I think probably most of the story books were aimed a little higher. I don't remember the books I was read until I started reading, when it was the Bobbsey Twins and the Little Colonel and those children's series. But I started reading chapter books right away. I did not spend much time on picture books, but I remember Dick and Jane, which was the first reading book in first grade. I remember it very well.
What did your parents do?
My mother was a stay-at-home mom, and my father was a banker. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in a very traditional kind of home.
This was in the 1930s.
1930s and 40s.
In Arizona. Do you remember your first interaction with television, your early interactions with television?
There was the Adlai Stevenson-Dwight Eisenhower campaign of 1951, maybe, or 52. And I watched Adlai Stevenson's acceptance speech at the convention. That was the first thing I remember. And then it was two or three years later that the Army-McCarthy hearings came on and changed history, and I watched some of that. I didn't have a TV set, so I was dependent on the kindness of neighbors to see television.
You were in New York City in your 20s. What made you come to New York?
I had known, I don't know, from the time I was the littlest child, that I would not live in Phoenix. And I went to the University of Arizona for college. And all during that period, my best friends were people that wanted to leave Phoenix and do something. And one of them, I went to Washington. So I joined her and her family in Washington after I graduated and worked for the federal government in the State Department. And then I went back to Phoenix and worked on a newspaper until I saved enough money to move to New York. But that was almost always the goal.
What did you do when you came to New York?
I tried to get a job at the New York Times and was eventually offered one on the women's page, naturally, and that was easy for me to turn down. What I had in mind was being an intrepid reporter on stories. And I had been on the women's page of the Arizona Republic, but they had given me lots of broader assignments than writing about weddings and tea parties and that sort of thing. And I knew the women's page at the Times would be restricted to weddings, and that was not for me. And I went into the press and public information department of RCA, which owned NBC. And as soon as I could, I transferred down to NBC and did publicized their soap operas and other kinds of programs that they had, other programs that they had.
And what was your personal life like at the time?
I lived with a girl I had grown up with in Phoenix, and she was an actress and in Hollywood most of the time. So I had her apartment, and she knew everybody in New York for a variety of reasons. Her family was in Phoenix very prominent, so they met every Easterner that came out, every famous Easterner. So she knew, she had a very wide circle of prominent friends, and she very generously shared all these people with me. So I was in a life that wasn't, that was very starry, and that part was fun, but I was, felt not up. I mean, here I was with no achievement at all, and I was with people who were directors of television plays and director of Broadway plays and heads of production companies and all of that. And here was little me, was how I felt. But eventually I left RCA and went to NBC and then left NBC because I couldn't make enough money to live, mm-hmm. practically, and went to work for the U.S. Steel Corporation to publicize their play that was on every 2 weeks on television called The U.S. Steel Hour.
What was that about, The U.S. Steel Hour?
It was a drama every 2 weeks. It alternated with someone else's, another corporation's drama. But ours was produced by the Theater Guild, which was a very prominent production, Broadway production company in New York. And so I learned a lot about theater, about casting. It was in the bad old days when we had there was a list of people you couldn't cast in, or whose names, whose plays you could not accept, because they were said to have red ties.
Communist ties.
Yeah. So it was an interesting period that you had to clear, that we had to clear all names with the advertising agency.
How did you develop an interest in entertainment and in journalism? Your dad was a banker. Your mom was a housewife from Arizona. How did you fall into that world?
Well, I took acting and acted in the plays, school plays, and little theater when I was in high school. So I always had an interest in being an actress. But my father said, if you are an actress, you will never receive a penny of support from me. Thank God he said that, because I had the interest, but I was much better behind the scenes, behind the camera, as it were. And I majored in education and came out certified to teach in Arizona, which I had no intention of doing. But in those days, mothers said to their daughters, in case your husband dies, you'll have a job that will give you the same hours as your children and the vacation time when your children have vacation time. So all the little girls of my generation, or many, majored in education. But I never was going to spend my life with children and women. I mean, at that time, I wanted to be where the action was, and that's where journalism and television and so on.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. The Sesame Workshop created Sesame Street in 1969. The germ of Children's Television Workshop started at a dinner party that you had at your home with your husband, then Tim Cooney.
That's correct.
At the time. How did that happen?
Tim and I were friends of Lloyd Morissette and Mary Morissette. Lloyd was vice president of Carnegie Corporation, the big foundation. And we were very close to my boss at Channel 13, who was a very theatrical, dramatic, and brilliant man. So he was there at the dinner party, plus someone I worked with named Anne Bement. So it was six of us. And Lewis, this very dramatic boss of mine, started talking in a very stunning, interesting, compelling way about the educational potential of television. His talk sparked something in Lloyd. Carnegie Corporation was financing studies of how children learn, child development, and so something clicked in his mind of why not use television to teach preschoolers? Because preschoolers were marching to the center of the stage at that time. The government was talking about creating something that became Head Start. Early childhood had become more interesting to educators than it had ever been before. And so he asked me if I'd be willing to take a leave of 3 months from being a producer at 13. I was producing adult shows, talk shows and documentaries, but I was frustrated because you can do one documentary after another and have no effect on the society. And I wanted to see if television could make a real difference. That had been haunting me. So it was a perfect moment for me when Lloyd said, "Would you like to do this?" And the answer is, yes, I would, even though my boss didn't want me to. He wanted me to stay at 13. I took a leave from programming for 3 months and went all over the country talking to educators of preschool children.
You wrote a paper as a result called "The Potential Uses of Television in Preschool Education." And what were the major findings of the paper?
I met with several gifted teachers of gifted children, teachers of preschool children who were in pilot programs that the government was doing as a precursor to Head Start. And if they had said no, this would be terrible. We couldn't have done it. But they were very supportive of the idea. It was all yes, why not? It was so I did a report on their reactions, and then I did described something like Sesame Street, an hour a day, a show that would be something like Sesame Street, run by a corporation, a nonprofit corporation, something like the Children's Television Workshop, which is now called Sesame Workshop. And so you could see it on paper, and it was very well received, the paper, by Carnegie and Ford and the government.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact. We'll hear more from Joan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact, among others. The Children's Television Workshop, now called the Sesame Workshop, started the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in 2007 to study the effects of digital technology on childhood literacy. Joan was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1990, and she's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So as a result of this paper, you suggested the launch of the Children's Television Workshop, and you suggested that they start a show which was at the time not called Sesame Street. Oh. How did you come up with the name Sesame Street?
Well, we were panic-stricken toward the end. We did not have a name. We had decided to put it on a street. We knew it was going to be on an inner-city street. We even knew what street. It was a copy of a street in East Harlem. And
which street was it? Do you know?
I can't remember, but it is something like East 116th Street. I've seen it. It was a street that, by the way, had a mural on one of the buildings, and we had that mural on Sesame Street. So once we knew we were on a street, we had to then find a title. There was even someone wanted to call it 123 Avenue B, and I said, that's too hip and too urban. So finally we got a list of about 60 titles, and we all decided that Sesame Street was the least bad. I don't know why we hated it, because we were hip. It was the late 60s, and so that's why Sesame Street seemed oh so sweet, and we did. Nobody wanted sweet, and then we all wanted sweet. I decided sweet was better. And so that was how we got Sesame Street. Partially, the head of our public information was saying, you guys are going to go on the air without any audience.
How did you come up with the idea of having the show be in a city with an urban feel?
Well, we had three extraordinarily gifted producers, John Stone, Sam Gibbon, and Dave Connell, all of whom had worked on Captain Kangaroo previously. John Stone was something of a genius, and everybody knew it at the time. And he's the one that came up with the urban street idea. And we all said, yeah, because our mandate was to reach inner city disadvantaged kids primarily. That is, if we didn't reach them it would, and reached everybody else, it would have been considered a failure.
At what point after it started airing did you say, wow, we have something much bigger here in our hands than we ever expected?
Right away, actually, as soon as it went on the air, the reaction was like swoosh. The press was overwhelmingly favorable, and the audience reaction was overwhelmingly favorable. There were some academic critics, but there were very few of those, and I remember every interview I did with the press, they'd say, how do you feel about your critics? I wanted to say, that is so the least of what we're dealing with here. To me, it was so actually trivial compared to what was really happening out there that it was like, for me, batting away flies. That's not nice to say, but that's how it felt. It was an amazing moment because the women's movement was coming on stream. So the press was not only deeply impressed with Sesame Street, but deeply impressed with the fact that a woman had founded it, which meant they all wanted to talk to me, I kept bringing along Dave Connell to interviews and felt terrible that these geniuses weren't getting the attention they should.
You launched Sesame Street in November 1969.
That's right.
And that was with the help of producers like John Stone, who had been at Captain Kangaroo
yes.
prior. How did you meet Jim Henson, and how did that collaboration begin?
Well, I had seen a reel of his work, and he was so admired within the industry, much less known outside, that it never crossed my mind that we could get him. And John Stone and Dave, and probably Sam too, had worked with him. They said to me, I think we'll talk to Jim Henson, the producer said. And I said, Jim Henson? I mean, to me that was like saying Peter the Apostle. It was amazing. And I said, do you think he would do it? And they said, who knows? But they went and talked to him, and he said he didn't want to do little children's shows, that he would then be categorized as a little children's producer, and that terrified him because he considered himself a family program producer, like The Muppet Show was his ideal show. However, he went home and thought, I have four children. He eventually had five, and it would be something to do for them and their peers. So I knew when we captured Jim Henson, I knew we had it, that we couldn't fail. And then Joe Raposo, the great composer, musician, came to work for us.
A lot of people came to you because they were driven by civil rights. How
yes,
come?
They were interested in children, but they were the idea of expressing the interest in what was going on in America, the civil rights movement, expressing it by trying to reach these children in need was very appealing to this group. Mm. I don't mean that they weren't interested in children because they were interested in civil rights, but the two interests they had came together perfectly.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. You mentioned right from the start that the show was widely accepted. What was harder for you than you thought it would be in getting Sesame Street off the ground?
What was harder? It was so much luck. We had so much luck. The timing could not have been better for raising the money, because at that time government and private foundations were, and then Corporation for Public Broadcasting came on stream, and public television as a big entity, they were interested. So the timing was all amazing. In the beginning, we had a hard time convincing some of the representatives of the federal government that Children's Television Workshop, an entity that did not exist and had never produced children's programming, headed by a woman who had never produced a children's program. It was hard convincing them that that was the way to go rather than give the money to a cartoon company. And so we had to kind of battle our way through that. But eventually everybody got aboard, even though a woman at one of the foundations, Ford, said it will never be taken seriously if a woman heads it.
How did you get funding for the show initially? You just talked about this perfect storm of the federal government and private foundations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting all coming together.
We couldn't possibly have raised it had it not been for the brilliance of Lloyd Morissette.
Who at the time was the head of the Carnegie Foundation.
He was vice president of Carnegie, but the driver of this particular project. He knew Harold Howe at the Department of, then the Office of Education, but it would be the department now. And that we wanted half the money from the government and got it.
How much money did you raise initially?
We raised $8 million originally. We raised four from the private foundations and CPB and four from the government.
Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Yes.
Now, $8 million in 1969, that's not an insignificant amount of money.
No, it would be like a 40 or 50 today, and people were shocked that that kind of money was being raised for a children's show. When we announced it, it was front page New York Times because it was unbelievable that anyone would spend that kind of money on children. And then the social purposes of the program caught the fancy of the Times and other press.
You mentioned the terrific response that the show got by critics, but there were still some people who were skeptical because you were using television as a medium. What were they saying?
I had made the mistake of saying that maybe we could close the gap between the achievement of poor children, disadvantaged children, and middle class, and that was picked up that within a few months that we certainly weren't closing the gap. And that was absolutely accurate because the middle class was making gains too. So it moved everybody up, but it didn't close any gap. So that was a very unfortunate phrase. So that was criticized.
Now, what was going on in your home life at the time? You didn't have children, so you didn't have to focus on that. But certainly your life had experienced this sea change, going from a producer of public television, and all of a sudden this storm comes of Children's Television Workshop and Sesame Street that was much larger than you ever expected. Can you talk me through those days of working on this early on?
Well, I was working all the time. And I think it was hard on my husband. I don't question that. That marriage ended in divorce in 1975, and it had nothing to do with Sesame Street, but I'm sure it was hard on him, all the focus on me. And I remember hating that we'd walk into a room and everyone would ignore him. So I'm sorry about it, but there was nothing I could do about it. And he was interesting. He was very involved in civil rights and was very helpful to me in many ways. He was the first feminist I ever knew. I had never met a woman who was a feminist, even.
Especially the woman at the Ford Foundation.
Right. But he was a feminist, so he was always pressing me to aim at being number one. He was also a very good writer and could help me when I was doing speeches and various things. But eventually he had problems that were not really manageable.
But he was always supportive of what you were doing.
Oh, very.
You are married now to Pete Peterson.
Yes.
And he is the founder of the Blackstone Group.
Yes.
Incidentally, did Pete Peterson play a role in Sesame Street at all?
He did, oddly enough. He was on the board of NET, and NET is was the old National Production Center for Public Broadcasting. And I wanted them to administer the workshop for the first year and a half because we didn't know if we wanted to hire lawyers and accountants and all that. What if we failed and had all this staff to fire? So my idea was hire those that we had to have and then ask NET to supply the lawyers, accountants, and administration. And in order to do that, Jack White, who was president, said, you've got to present that to my board, and they've got to approve. And Pete Peterson was on the board, and he asked question after question. He was just fascinated with the idea and came up and said, this is one of the most interesting ideas I've ever heard. Well, naturally, I never forgot him. But we were both married to different people. Our lives went on in separate ways. And then we finally met again when both of us were divorced. It was very romantic.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. The Sesame Workshop created Sesame Street. What did Sesame Street look like in 1969?
It was slower. It was accused of being too fast-paced. But when I look at the early shows, they seem very slow to me. We've changed it a lot now. Elmo was not on early shows and became the superstar when we were about the superstar when we were about 20 years into it. And he now greatly is far more popular than Big Bird. But Big Bird is iconic. I always say he is held up like a crucifix to vampires in the Congress every time they threaten to cut us.
So Sesame Street took off immediately in the United States.
Yes.
When did it start to go global?
Well, the Germans came to me within a year and asked if they could do a co-production for Germany. And their Big Bird was a bear. And Bert and Ernie are a huge sensation in Germany, and have always been. And then the next thing that happened was that Latin America wanted a version, and we ended up doing that in Mexico for all of Latin America except Brazil. And then it began spreading to the Netherlands, Canada, which took the American show but makes inserts Canadian films, and they've made it. It's called Sesame Street North. Australia, the English-speaking countries like Australia and Canada wanted it pretty quickly.
Except for England.
Except for England. Just wanted the Muppet pieces, did not want Sesame Street because they did not want Americans teaching English children. Now, of course, we're in Bangladesh, we're in South Africa with an AIDS-positive Muppet, and we're working in Pakistan, and we're starting an Afghanistan version.
And how is that perceived by society in Afghanistan, which tends to be conservative? How do you make adjustments accordingly?
We work with their people mm-hmm. and their educators, and they choose what they want to emphasize. They may not want to emphasize letters and numbers. They may want to emphasize the values of mutual respect and understanding, which is a big value in our foreign productions. There's one version in Northern Ireland, which emphasizes mutual respect and understanding. We're in Israel and Palestine with different versions. We had hoped to have more unity, but it didn't work out.
And there are characters that remain the same throughout all the countries, like is Oscar the Grouch in all of these?
So Oscar is, and Big Bird are the same puppeteer. No, they, for example, Israel's Big Bird, or the iconic Muppet, is a porcupine. Tough on the outside, soft on the inside. One Israeli said it should be the reverse.
Your whole life has been focused on children's education through entertainment, yet you don't have any children of your own. How come?
Well, I wanted children, and that just didn't happen. I really was deeply disappointed in my first marriage that didn't happen, but it didn't. I ended up with 5 stepchildren and 9 grandchildren. So children are very much in my life now and have been for many years. Many, many, many of the greatest artists, writers, playwrights, book writers of children's television, of children's material, have never married and don't have children. Maurice Sendak is one that's never married and has no children.
He's Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah. So is the author of Alice in Wonderland, I believe. I don't know. It's a very, many, many men, many single men are big artists and writers of children's material. I can't be sure, but I would suggest it's because they still have the child in them for whatever reasons.
Do you feel like you have an inner child or a child within you?
Yes, I do, unfortunately. But the grown-up has conquered. And those are those that keep the child stay creative, and those that have the grown-up conquers become the executives. Darn. I have this theory that we're all sort of a combination of our fathers and mothers, and that my father triumphed finally in me because much of me was very satisfied with being an executive, of bringing order out of chaos and being the boss. I really loved being the boss. I made up an aphorism that was in Forbes magazine, which is, I've been bossed and I've been boss, and believe me, being boss is better.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of Children's Television Workshop and one of the founders of Sesame Street. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over 4 countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase 2, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase 3, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. the thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there were something like 18,000 university graduates of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly. And it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom. Mm-hmm. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey. Mm-hmm.
So
then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, you know, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for the campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. Mm. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money, and you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, and mm-hmm. what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18 running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back at a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.